Alors, j'ai préparé un texte, mais d'abord, j'aimerais parler juste un petit peu de ce projet-là, Spoken Web. So, historicizing with digital design, or what building a digital archive has taught me about the material archive. I want to talk about this project just a little bit in general before I move into talking about sort of what the digital has taught me about the material. It's a good time for me to do this because I'm in my very last year of funding, sort of extended past, you know, the year that you're, you know, supposed to have finished. And I have a lot of questions about what I may or may not do next. This is a very local project, started as a very local project. The year I arrived at Concordia University in 1999, my very first meeting with the department chair, I was in his office and he was telling me what I had to do and stuff. And my eyes started wandering around the room, and on the top of his bookshelf, I saw a whole bunch of tapes. These are the tapes that I saw. Basically, I said, "What are those?" And he said, "Those are recordings of a poetry series that were held at Sir George Williams University in the 60s and 70s. I left the office and I worked my way towards tenure, and then around 2007, I sort of remembered these tapes again. And I started thinking about them. In the interim, the chair had deposited them with the university archives at Concordia. And they had received a grant to digitize all of these tapes. These are about 80 plus poets from across North America, sort of Black Mountain poets, Beat poets, Tish poets, all Anglophone. There wasn't a single Francophone poet reading in the series. And they were all recorded on reel-to-reel tapes. So in 2007, the archives converted them to WAV format. It was a three-year process, and they put them on CDs. So what was a kind of perfectly useless archive in analog tape became an equally useless archive on CD, in my opinion. It was great that they had digitized them, though. And so in order to make them sort of more research-friendly, I guess, I wanted to develop a catalog. So the first idea wasn't even a digital project necessarily, although I did have that sort of further in mind. And I applied for a first grant just to transcribe the audio, essentially. I didn't transcribe all of the audio, but we used Transcrivia software, which is a transcription software, to transcribe all of the extra poetic speech, so all of the talking that the poets do in between reading poems, and to timestamp every poem and to put the title of the poem. So we created, what we were doing really was creating the data that upon which we could then develop a website, but we were also initially just trying to build a catalog that could be useful for researchers who wanted to know if Allen Ginsberg had read this poem at this reading, you know, when he was in Montreal. So they got deposited in the phone. This is a screenshot of this transcript that we developed with all the timestamps. You know, it was just as a PDF. Okay, and you could see there's, it says index, index, index. We were already thinking, okay, how are we going to index and search these things? We never followed up on actually building an index vocabulary for indexing the entire collection. You can search. Now in the website, it seems like you can search the audio, but really you're searching text, and I'll talk a bit more about that. So then we developed another grant, so I got an RDI grant, and we just focused on basic digital presentation of these materials. This is what Spoken Web sort of looks like now. This isn't even the early version, but this is what the recordings looked like initially when they appeared on their site. Sort of like the Fugazi site in a way. It's just a list, right? You know, a long list. To some extent organized by year, 1966, but there was a lot of basic metadata that we didn't have on these tapes, you know. So a good part of the research was, you know, around finding out about each of these recordings, when they were made, where they were made, etc. So this is an early version of what the site looked like. I'll just go quickly to the website as it is now. And we've moved into a slightly different version of the interface. So that this is how the recordings appear now. And as we've learned more about the tapes, more about these actual artifacts and the events that they document, we came up with different ways of filtering them, essentially. So we can filter them by year, we can filter them by poet, and we can filter them by series, which we learned because they were actually identified in terms of series, which we only learned about after listening to the tapes and studying them for a while. I get out of the website. Back here. As we developed the site, we, you know, came to an agreement with SoundCloud, and they gave us access for free for the 5-year period of the project to use their audio player. And we took that first transcription that I mentioned, which was time stamped, and we developed code, basically, plugin that would allow us to tether the audio to the timestamps, so that if you want to actually now find a particular place in the audio, all you have to do is click on the timestamp. And the same thing, if you click on the audio, it'll bring you to that moment in the transcript. So that took about a year to actually, you know, come to that. And navigation was the sort of primary problem that we explored in the first RDI grant. Now, another part of the project which we've made little, you know, less headway on has had to do with playing with the signal itself, right? And finding interesting ways to visualize the sound signal. This is Melodyne, this is audio software that is really almost a 3D way of exploring the sound signal. You can go all the way around the audio signal and transform it like it's a sculpture, and in fact sculptures have been made out of Melodyne visualizations. This is a waveform sculpture. There are other sort of visualization tools that we've been exploring. This is Pratt, which is a very ugly tool designed for linguists, you know. But it's very accurate in terms of visualizing waveforms, pitch contours, and formants. That's what these two, the blue things are the pitch contours, and behind it the gray thing are formants, you know. And we're exploring this year, so the main things that we're looking into this year are sort of different modes of visualization of the audio. Finally, we're sort of getting back to that. And there are a couple of other things we're doing. We're developing a calendar so that we can allow other people to begin to map other readings that took place, not just in Montreal, by those poets. And also to visualize poetic speech in relation to extra poetic speech in relation to silences, which is very easy to sort of visualize based on the way we marked up the audio textually, so that you could have graphs even to say which poet speaks the most and reads the least, you know, things like that, you know, which is sort of fun. Like Robert Duncan was one of the poets, and the ratio of his extra poetic speech to his actual poetry reading is, you know, he talks way more than he reads versus other poets who hardly speak at all, you know. So that might be interesting to some scholars. The last thing I'll say about the, you know, intro to the project is I approached it from the very beginning as not a big data project. So I approached it as a little data project, and sort of almost thinking of it in terms of a little magazine or something like that. We're building a site that's sort of little data, and if I approach it as a little magazine, in audio terms I'd say it's a lo-fi project. I found a blog post that I wrote on the site early on, and sort of just looked at it again yesterday, that described our philosophy as a bricolage design philosophy. So, and there were a few reasons at the time that I thought this was important. One was we didn't have a lot of money for development. Two, anything we could build was already being built better in many ways by others, right? So we were going sort of out of the box. It was a plug-in-y, I put it that way, a plug-in-y approach to things. And we explored different content management systems, but we chose WordPress, you know, the most popular one, in a way, you know, as the equivalent of sort of our digital mimeograph machine or something like that. sustainability, you know, so if the four main preoccupations of this last year, the project, are sustainability, and I say sustainability, ha, right? One of the other reasons maybe to go lo-fi or little data or to go out of the box and sort of this bricolage approach is it'll probably last longer, right? With less money if we do that, right? But I think from the very beginning, and probably in part because of the nature of the events that we're documenting, I approached this digital project not as an archive, right? Or if I ever used the word archive, it always had quotation marks around it, but as an event. So I'm thinking of this as a digital event project to some extent. And even the website and the versions of the sites that we're creating over time, we think of them as events that are sort of loci for a whole bunch of other activities, which are, you know, being performed around the research we're doing about these reading series, right? But not as, this is not my responsibility to preserve these materials for posterity, right? Partly, I can say that because all of the tapes are deposited in an actual archive that has that obligation. It's Concordia University Archive. But we also wanted to sort of model, because it's rare in a way that poetry recordings of this kind exist in university archives and were actually recorded by university AV departments, as this series was. It's an interesting sort of institutional history as to why that was. But there are thousands and thousands of similar poetry recording tapes across North America in shoeboxes, in basements, all over the place, right? And in a way, part of our project was to model the possibilities of creating your own sort of, again, Fugazi-like almost personal archive with your own materials or your own collection of audio. Aggregation, which is one sort of an issue that has been raised, has been a preoccupation of ours from the beginning. And if I want to go forward with this project, you know, beyond my little data approach, then aggregation becomes a really sort of big question. It's one that we've explored, but we didn't necessarily tackle, for this project. The question of our audio player, I could probably renew my agreement with SoundCloud, but, you know, is that a sustainable approach if I want to keep this site up even beyond next year? So one thing we're going to be asking ourselves is, do we want to just integrate our own audio player rather than, you know, keep our relationship with SoundCloud going? I said visuals and visualization plugins and copyright wrangles, which is something we've avoided quite largely, you know, throughout the project. We've taken the Kenny Goldsmith approach for the most part and just done whatever we wanted. Because it's poetry, no one cares anyways. So no one has contacted us and raised concerns. But anyhow, those are sort of the last sort of pressing issues. All right, I guess I'm not even going to be able to deliver the paper, it seems. But I do want to sort of tell you, I'll give you the gist of sort of what I was going to say about so how the digital archive sort of teaches us about the material. I'd say that in order to answer the question, what is it that we're actually presenting, right? And how then do we present it? We immersed ourselves increasingly in trying to analyze and learn about the material artifacts. So we had the audio, we transcribed it, but we took this sort of idea as articulated by Jerome McGann recently in his book, A New Republic of Letters, quite seriously throughout the project. The need to migrate our cultural heritage to a digital condition has exposed the serious limitations in such an approach to the study of our cultural inheritance. The historical record is composed of a vast set of specific material objects that have been created and passed along through an even more vast network of agents and agencies. The meanings of the record, the interpretation of those meanings, are a function of the operations taking place in that dynamic network. Only a sociology of the textual condition can offer an interpretive method adequate to the study of this field and its materials. Jerome McGann's kind of a downer in some ways in terms of re-articulating our responsibility to the material artifacts that we're digitizing and migrating through various media and playing with, et cetera, right? It's, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he started as, a sociologist of texts and a textual bibliographer, essentially. So his early work is on creating editions, right? And so another way to think about, an informing concern of our project was we treated our work with the artifacts and the creation of Spoken Web as if we were creating a kind of an edition of the tapes, right? By finding as much metadata as we possibly could and actually understanding the tapes themselves. And I'll just give you sort of a quick list of, we spent a lot of time looking at these things, deciphering them, and then trying to figure out what it meant. And I'll give you just one example. I have a couple of minutes. We looked at the tape boxes. What we learned was, the collection of tapes consists of 82 original reels of audio tape, which were produced by the AV department, right, and 36 reels of duplicated tapes marked by the English department. And then there were all kinds of variations between these two versions of the tapes, depending on what speed they were recorded at, whether they were recorded in mono or stereo, so how many tapes that existed as a result of producing the particular recording. When they were migrated, so when the archive migrated the tapes from tape to CD, right, they didn't distinguish between the English department tapes and the original AV tapes. They chose some from some group and some from another group, and it resulted in all kinds of cuts between the readings that we wouldn't have understood or, in a way, were artificially created as a result of the migration, right? But that we could only, in a sense, re-decipher and then actually re-wed the digital files in a way after looking back at the tapes themselves. I'll give you just one example. So partly we do that through looking at the tape speeds and the versions of the tapes themselves. And another way we do it was by looking at the actual tapes themselves. So this is an image of one of the Allen Ginsberg reel-to-reel tapes. And what do you notice about this tape? So you see the leader tape is the white tape here. And you'll notice there are white leader tape lines at various points, right? So those represent editorial interventions on the tape itself, right? The English tapes have these. The AV tapes don't, right? There are actual different versions. So if you're actually doing an edition of the recordings, right, you have to do a kind of a forensic analysis of the material object and then decide how you present, right, this digitally, right? I'll give you a sense of, these are the splices that you see here. This is just a digital version of it, and I'll just play it for you real quickly. I should actually say that banging that you hear at the beginning, Allen Ginsberg's reading consisted of 20 minutes of Hare Krishna chanting, with about 8 Hare Krishnas in the room before the reading actually began. So what you're hearing at the beginning of this recording is just the Hare Krishnas, so I'll play it again. And then you'll hear the edits. I mean, the point here is really to hear the edits. I'm trying to get the audio up here, but...
Welcome to the June 10th, 1963, Siem Reap, Cambodia.
Together, I'm really showing you.
I want to read a couple poems from a book published in Toronto by Anansi Press. The moving van arrives empty at the doctor's house full of Chinese furniture.
Okay, so the point here is just to show these three silences that you see, not the white spaces, but the silences, those are the white tape edits.
That are songs of innocence and experience.
Okay. Other of the recordings, and I'm just going to play you one other clip, have edits that aren't visible on the tapes, but that are audible in the audio.
A town outside of the ruins. Encore.
Okay. Between that first sample and the second, there's actually a gap there. There's no leader tape on the tapes themselves, right? But there is an edit that was made by the recordist while it was happening. It's just like you press pause while you're reading, right? So anyways, the whole point of you know, what I wanted to raise here is how deciding what it was we were presenting and how we actually present the audio tapes required us to go back to the material object in a very, you know, serious, almost obsessive way, right? And then to, in a sense, reconstruct the digital files so that we could not replicate the event, but best represent the documentary material of the original live event that we can never recapture. So I'll stop there. Thank you.